What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off.
Ryan Dennehy is a three-time entrepreneur and the founder and CEO of Electric, which is revolutionizing IT support with the world's first automated IT platform. His previous two startups were both acquired by public companies. In this conversation, we discuss the three jobs of a CEO, hiring and firing, the most underrated startup hire, how to communicate with a board of directors, and why you can't outwork bad people. I really enjoyed this conversation with Ryan, and I hope you guys do too. But before we get into the episode, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is a brand new sponsor that I've uncovered, and you guys are going to love it. It's called HelloFresh. Everyone knows I love Domino's on Saturday, but during the week, the secret is I eat super, super healthy. In order to do that, it's got to be easy, it's got to be some sort of variety so I don't get bored with it, and it's got to be flexible so Palin and I don't get stuck to a schedule. Well, that's what HelloFresh has done for us. They offer convenient, no-contact delivery straight to your doorstep of easy home cooking. The recipes are dumb simple. Literally, if I can do it, you can do it. If Palin can do it, you can do it. The recipes are easy to follow with simple steps. And the best part, they even have pictures to guide you along the way. So an idiot like me can literally follow the pictures and end up with an awesome meal. They cut out all the stressful meal planning and the grocery store trips so you can just enjoy cooking and get dinner on the table in about 30 minutes. The best part is that if you use HelloFresh, you'll save about 40% by buying through HelloFresh rather than shopping at the grocery store. So what do they actually send you? Well, they deliver fresh, high-quality, pre-portioned ingredients so you can make meals that are delicious and nutritious. Really key part, they're delicious. Over 90% of the ingredients are sourced directly from growers to ensure peak flavor and ripeness. They offer more than 20 chef-crafted, delicious options every week to help you break out of your recipe rut, try new things, and make any night feel special. There is something that every single one of you will enjoy, including 20-minute meals, low-calorie, vegetarian, kid-approved recipes, and more. I didn't believe any of this before I tried it. It is easy. There is tons of variety, and it is simple to make. But the best part is it's also flexible. You can change the delivery days and meal plan preferences or skip a week whenever you need right on their mobile app. Literally, it is dummy-proof. If I can do it, you can do it. So keep your fridge stocked by adding all these extra meals. We've got a ton of them. Palina loves it. If it's Palina approved, it's good enough for you. There's also additional proteins, quick meals like breakfast on the go, 10-minute lunches, and even desserts to satisfy your sweet tooth. So go try out HelloFresh.com. Use the code POMP90, POMP90. Or you can go to HelloFresh.com/POMP90 and you will get $90 off, including free shipping in your first order. They're going to give you $90 off. Go try it. Free shipping. It's like a no-brainer. HelloFresh.com/POMP90. And when you get there, just remember, damn, Pomp's the man because he got me $90 off. HelloFresh. Using code POMP90. Go check it out. You guys will love it. I promise. Next sponsor is Athletic Brewing. While you're having your HelloFresh meal, you can sit and drink your non-alcoholic beer Sunday through Thursday night. Because Friday and Saturday is for Bud Light, but Sunday through Thursday night is for Athletic Brewing. They're all about reimagining beer for the modern adult. They've got great tasting beer that happens to have no alcohol and be a mere fraction of the calories of even the lightest beers. In today's modern mindful performance-driven world, there ain't no time for hangovers. With Athletic Beer, you can have the full relaxing ritual of drinking a great beer to wind down the day. You can have it with dinner. You can day drink. You can shotgun it. You can do whatever you want, but it won't derail the rest of your day or week. If you're looking for a great beer for Sunday through Thursday nights, Athletic's got you covered. My refrigerator is packed with them. When my brothers come over, they shotgun them because they're crazy, but they're crazy good too. Their beers have won awards on multiple continents, including the World Beer Awards Best Non-Alcoholic Beer multiple times. They've even won awards and full-strength or reverse full-strength beers. I didn't believe that it would taste like real beer, but it is shockingly accurate. shockingly accurate. They taste exactly like real beer, just don't have the alcohol. So give them a try. You'll get 25% off your first order at athleticbrewing.com if you use code POMP25. Again, athleticbrewing.com, use code POMP25 for 25% off your first order. I don't know what's up. HelloFresh giving you $90 off. Athletic Brewing giving you 25% off. Basically, it's like free money. Go and check it out. Lastly, is CoinList. If you got good food and you got good non-alcoholic beer, let's get you some good investing. Smart crypto investors know that being early is critical to success. CoinList is built for early adopters. Since 2017, CoinList has been providing early access to the highest quality projects before other exchanges. Their exchange, CoinList Pro, has all the features you've come to expect from a professional crypto exchange, including advanced order types, APIs, secure wallets, and low fees, but you'll also get first access to all of the CoinList supported projects. So in crypto, it pays to be early, and CoinList is where early adopters invest in, earn, and trade the best crypto projects before other exchanges. Key part, before other exchanges, go check out CoinList today. Now, you have to go to coinlist.co/pomp. Coinlist.co/pomp. I could like turn into a song. Coinlist.co/pomp. Go there. I think that they're going to give you all kinds of cool stuff, and you can even earn some Bitcoin after you traded your first $100. So go to CoinList. You see that? I like literally love it so much. I had to say it again. Coinlist.co/pomp. Go earn some Bitcoin when you trade your first $100 on CoinList, because on CoinList, you'll never be late to the party. All right. Go check out HelloFresh. Go check out Athletic Brewing. Go check out CoinList. Tell them I sent you. Let's get into this episode with Ryan. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys. Bang, bang. I've got Ryan here with me. Thank you so much for doing this, sir.
I'm stoked to be here.
Absolutely. Let's jump right into your background. You've built and sold two companies and now working on your third. Kind of walk us through your journey to becoming a three-time startup founder and CEO.
Yeah. Very first company got started young. It was an online ad network called Banquet. And basically, we sold ads on other people's extreme sports websites. And so that was as big of a business as it sounds like. we were about $1 million in revenue when we got acquired. It was sold in business to USA Today Sports on New Year's Day 2008. I was in my junior year at Hofstra and barely graduated while, you know, trying to work for a public company and finish my work there. Stayed there for 4 years, had a good time. Ultimately, while I loved the ad business, in some respects, I just couldn't see myself selling squares and rectangles on web pages for the rest of my life. I left in 2012 with my co-founder from that company, a guy named Rudd Davis. Moved to San Francisco, started a company called Swarm. It was a retail analytics platform for small business retailers, so we could tell you foot traffic, conversion, sales in a web dashboard. That was a slightly better business. Still really challenging. We attempted to build our own hardware, which I would not recommend to any founder. But we ended up having a really great outcome. Sold the business to Groupon in November 2014. And at that point, I moved back to New York. Rudd and I went our separate ways. He and I are still, you know, best friends. He started a company though called Blackbird, which was later acquired by Surf Air, which will be going public soon through a SPAC. So that has worked out really well for him. I got back to New York in 2016 and started Electric. And so the premise for Electric is pretty simple. We do managed IT support for small and mid-sized companies, but we sell it as a subscription SaaS solution with some services. So, you know, instead of having some, you know, the old way of doing it, right, some random local dude IT consultant who takes a day to return your call, right? If you work with Electric, we integrate with Slack and Microsoft Teams. You have a web-based dashboard. You have an awesome account manager. So we've really kind of modernized IT management. So that business is doing very well. We have about 250 employees. raised about $60 million. We're doing kind of mid eight figures in recurring revenue. And yeah, that's probably the fastest I've run through my highlight reel. So I'll turn it back to you.
Explain what IT support is for those that don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, nowadays in 2020, you know, what it means is basically three sort of major food groups. The first is SaaS management, right? So you've got companies now, the average business we work with is about 100 employees, and they're using anywhere from 50 to 75 different applications, right? And 10 years ago, you might have used five, right? So just SaaS management, doing that in a really cohesive, efficient, secure way, that's a big responsibility. Then it's device management. So if you have 100 employees, or even if you have 20 employees or 200 employees, you got to make sure that those computers, that you know where they are, that they're secure, that they're running correctly. So we handle that. And then the third piece is network and server management. So if you have some physical infrastructure, making sure that that's running correctly, that it's secure, tie it all together into sort of, you know, one cohesive, easy to manage solution. So pretty straightforward.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I really appreciate about kind of the way you approach building companies is you are very straightforward, right? So there's no kind of bullshit here. You're like, look, you learn on the job. It's really hard. If you're good at it, then it can be very rewarding. But like the celebritization of founding companies and being a startup founder doesn't tell the whole story. And you basically through Twitter and kind of a bunch of different mediums explain like, here is what it takes to do this. And maybe sometimes you do it well and sometimes you don't do it well, but like this is what it kind of entails. Where does that interest come from? Or like, why are you drawn to sharing that type of information?
I think because I was so bad at my job for so long.
I mean, that's a good reason.
My first two companies were dumpster fires. You know, we ended up having good outcomes, but every possible mistake. I mean, we were talking about fundamentally flawed business models mixed with the wrong talent at the wrong times, mixed with, you know, me and you know, Rudd and I, in our first two companies, not knowing anything about how to, you know, manage the people who worked for us, not knowing how to manage up to the board. And so, you know, every day it wasn't a question of like, oh, is today going to be a good day? It was like, how many fires am I going to have to contend with today? And so, you know, it wasn't until the tail end of my time running Swarm back in like 2014, where I finally had been doing this for so long and just screwing up enough things that it just sort of clicked that like this, you know, the sooner I can acknowledge that I suck at a lot of things and the sooner I can get really focused on seeking out answers from people who have done the things that I've done before, like the better I'm going to get at the job, and the better I get at the job, the more fun I'm going to have and the more successful the company is going to be. But it's just so hard, even if you think of yourself as a relatively high EQ person, it's so hard when you have all this confidence driving you as a founder to also admit that you really don't have all the answers. And that in most cases, you're probably going to be wrong and that you've got to turn to other people to get the answers. So once I saw the benefits of actually just kind of embracing that mindset, all of a sudden I started learning faster. I started doing better. My company started doing better. And so to me, it's just something I'm really passionate about and like talk about.
Absolutely. So you've got this one tweet where you said, look, here's the three jobs of the CEO, right? You said recruiting, storytelling, and awareness. Maybe walk us through why are those the three things that you feel like are the most important to focus on?
Yeah. I mean, it's cliche at this point to point to the fact that like, oh, the team is everything, but it is, right? At the end of the day, like a software business is a completely fictional concept, right? Like we don't sell anything. I don't have a warehouse full of electric licenses somewhere. I don't have an assembly, you know what I mean? Like end of the day, like our company and really any technology business is just a collection of people who all generally believe in the same thing and agree to work on something together, right? And so the quality of the company you build is entirely contingent on the quality of the people, and not just the quality of the individuals, but can I hire a group of people who are all going to work well together, right? One of my board members, Tim Harvey, he said this to me. He's like, dude, it took me till my third time being CEO to realize it's not about the best talent. It's about the best team. And those two things are not always the same thing. And so, you know, when I think back to my first two companies, almost every problem that we had, almost every business problem that we had was actually a people problem, right? And I see this all the time when I get a founder who calls me and is like, hey, like I have a sales problem. And it's like, no, you have a people problem. And the people problem is that you actually have a marketer who's not delivering any leads, and you have a product person who's not shipping what the customers want. Sales are actually the least of your worries, right? And so I think it's just, it can't be emphasized enough that the only way you're ever going to build a company that's really going to be worth anything is focusing on the people first, focusing on the team. So that's the first one. The second one, storytelling. You know, as a founder and CEO, at every stage of the journey, you're only as good as what you can get people to believe in, right? Metrics are great, but at the end of the day, if you're trying to secure financing, if you're trying to hire those great people to come work for you, if you're trying to get the story in front of a big customer, if you're trying to explain, you know, internally what's going on to sort of keep morale high, you have to become an expert at distilling things that are extremely complicated and, frankly, most of the time not that interesting, and make them very simple and very exciting. It's not dissimilar to, like, one of the core principles of pop music and, like, writing pop music is taking something that's really unique and making it so that everybody can understand it, and therefore anybody can be a one-hit wonder as long as people get what you're doing. I mean, it's no different with storytelling in a startup. In fact, it's even more important. Like, how can you take something as unsexy as IT support and get to a place where people are throwing tens of millions of dollars at you and leaving their jobs to come work for you, right? So, and there's a skill to that, but you just have to do it a lot, right? And the third piece, which I think makes the first two work really well together, is awareness. You just have to have, you have to get to a place where you can be a spectator to your own thoughts, right? So, like, every day you're going to have stuff that blows up. Every day you're going to have people mad at you. Every day you're going to have things that you're uncertain about. But to be able to step outside of yourself constantly and say, why am I feeling this way? Why are things going this way? Like, am I doing a good job? You can't let it get to a place where you just go into some, like, tailspin of anxiety. I mean, I've been there, as have probably most people, but you've got to constantly be able to just get to a place where you can take a step back and really ask yourself the tough questions. Is this going well? Am I being a jerk? Do I have the right people on the team? You know, because ultimately, like most businesses that wind up being successful, it's because they avoided the things that killed them more so than it was because they were really brilliant and executed on a bunch of amazing things.
Absolutely. And one of the things that you talked about a little bit there in recruiting, but you've elaborated on, is this idea that, like, just as you can't out-train a bad diet, you right. can't outwork bad people on the team. Talk a little bit about how, I'm assuming you learned that lesson by experiencing it and then came to the realization, but kind of how do you think about that today?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's been in a situation, particularly, you know, whether you're a business owner or you're a manager of people, or you're on a team that's where you're working with colleagues, where everyone at some point in their career has been in a situation where you're just going in circles, you're going in circles, you're in meetings, everyone's talking past each other, nobody can agree to goals, or you agree to goals, but you kind of know that no one's ever going to hit them. And when those things start happening, almost always what that means is that you've got the wrong person on the team, or maybe it's the wrong people. And I think that the problem that a lot of people have, I certainly had it, was that most people don't really know what excellent looks like, don't know what world-class really looks like. And so it's easy to be in a situation where maybe you're managing somebody or you're colleagues with someone and they went to the right school, they have all the right experience from, you know, some other company they worked at, they're a nice person seemingly, right? And so that it's, but you wake up 6 months later and you're like, we've gotten nowhere on this initiative. We've made no progress on this thing. And you're just continuing to go in circles. It's like, guess what? What's the common denominator? That person, maybe that person's you, right? I don't know. But, you know, that's the single biggest thing. And where CEOs often make mistakes and frankly nuke their businesses is that they have the wrong people on the team, and they either take too long to realize that that's the root cause, or they know that that's the root cause and they don't act fast enough.
Yeah. One of the things that I think a lot of this gets back to is like communication, right? So it's the CEO communicating to the people, people being able to communicate back to the CEO, and kind of horizontal and vertical communication. I remember at Facebook in 2014, when I was working there, basically product managers interview prospective product managers, and they kind of have this unique hiring process. And that year I said, hey, I want to get much better at interviewing. So I just, every time there was an opportunity to do it, I would just volunteer and say, hey, I'll interview that person. And in it, one of the tracks is basically like a made up situation, like a war game almost, right? So you would say to somebody, hey, Ryan, you're in charge of this team here at Facebook. You go home on Friday. Everything's great. Monday morning, you come in and traffic to your product has dropped 50%. What do you do? Right. And basically you just talk through them, and kind of as they begin to tell you what they would do, you would feed them more information. And I'll never forget that during that exercise, I probably did, I don't know, somewhere between 80 to 100 interviews doing this. One person said, the first thing I would do is I would immediately alert every stakeholder that we had a problem.
There you go.
One person. And I remember being like, this person is the person that we need to hire because they've done this before. They understand how important communication is. Like, they're team oriented, like just all the things you're talking about. It was so interesting that only one out of all of these people jumped to, let me communicate first. Everyone else said, let me solve the problem. Let me jump in and try to figure out the answer. And I think that is kind of the differentiation between somebody who's high quality and then somebody who may be good, but they're not kind of that world-class, highly experienced person.
I mean, you're totally right. I mean, communication is the thing that either makes or breaks most relationships, business or, you know, personal, right? And most people know that, right? And that's something that we've, at least at Electric, you know, the way that we run the company now is like, we've acknowledged the fact that it takes maintenance, it takes effort, it takes, you know, I was talking to my VP of product this morning, and, you know, we were talking about the fact that, yeah, as an executive team, we all came together very organically. Everybody kind of hit it off right off the gate. We did a bunch of hiring last year, so we basically doubled the size of our exec team about a year ago. But one of the things that we were talking about is that there's this tendency when you have people who already are very aligned and getting along well and everyone's kind of clicking, there's a tendency to actually underinvest in those relationships and say, hey, you know what? Like, hey, you know, me and Pomp, we get along, like we're all good. We don't need to set aside all this time. We don't have to, you know, it's the opposite. It's that if you actually are lucky enough to have that chemistry with your coworkers or with your boss or whatever, those are the relationships that you want to double down on. And you have to be really, really intentional about cultivating trust and figuring out everyone's, you know, kind of unique communication styles and investing in the quality of those relationships, because you're only going to get so far sort of just getting there by accident or sort of getting there organically. And I mean, that's just where I've seen just at other companies, you know, otherwise very high performing, high potential individuals just go sideways because of bad communication. And so I think that'll be an issue most humans have probably till the end of time. But, you know, it's an important thing to focus on because of that.
We've talked a lot about kind of the executive team communicating with each other or also communicating with employees. You mentioned earlier kind of managing the board or managing up to the board, and talk a little bit about kind of the communication there. And most CEOs, especially first-time startup founders, they've just never had a board of directors before. And so kind of talk through a little bit about the relationship between being a founding CEO, the board, how you communicate and manage kind of those outsiders/investors.
Yeah, I mean, look, the board is either going to be your biggest asset or at some point could wind up becoming very problematic. You know, most VCs, I've been doing this almost 15 years now, like most VCs really do want the founder to succeed. They want everything to go well, and they really want to have the founder's back. You know, Fred Wilson wrote a post recently about, you know, when it's time to fire the CEO. And I mean, even he said, look, it's only in, you know, pretty extreme circumstances that's considered, but like anything, like what we were just talking about, you have to invest in those relationships. And so one thing I did a really poor job with, I think in the early days of Electric and at my previous companies, was like, I didn't really understand or respect the fact that, like, hey, the board, one, they're ostensibly my bosses, right? And so like, you want to be communicating with your bosses a lot too. You want to establish good relationships. But the third thing was like, The more open and transparent and clear and free the communication is, the more trust you build every time an email update goes out, every time a text message comes in, right? And the more trust that's built there, the more productive those relationships become. So like in the early days of Electric, you know, I would get an email from like, you know, Bob Goodman at Bessemer, and he'd be like, hey, we should catch up. And I'd be like, oh shit, oh no, like Bob wants to talk. It's like, I'm just like one of a dozen portfolio companies and he hasn't heard from me in a while and he's curious what we've been up to, right? And I would rush and try to put together some big update and it would be like this kind of awkward conversation. And I remember before we raised our Series B, he called me and he's like, hey, so he's like, you know, you really got to step your game up. You know, we're going to be bringing in some big money for this next round. And, you know, I think you just really got to step up the professionalism with how we kind of manage things. And, you know, once Jeff Richards from GGV, he led our Series B, great podcast that you guys did, by the way, a few weeks ago. You know, he came in and just kind of used that as like an opportunity to sort of turn over a new leaf and say, all right, everything good, bad, and ugly. I'm going to be clear. I'm going to be concise. Anytime I have news that is material to the business, it's boom, it's going to go to them. And it completely changed my relationship with the board. You know, I send them updates almost weekly. They're not formal. You know, for example, our professional services group hit a big milestone on Sunday night. I just forwarded the email from the guy who runs that department to the board. And the board's like, hey, this is awesome. Great. Thanks. A little bit of stuff like that every single week. By the time you get to the board meeting, everyone's like, nah, cool. Like, we know what's going on. Let's talk about the strategy, right? But it's just so hard for a first-time founder, I think, and even some multi-time founders to wrap their head around the fact that like your board, they are your friends, or at least they want to be. Okay. So you just got to be honest and you got to communicate often with them.
One time somebody said to me, the problem with boards and startup founders, especially first-time founders who don't yet understand how to use the board, is that founders look at the board as a fundraising mechanism, right? They look at them as a potential problem solver, and then always looming over their shoulder is the board could fire me, right? Or the board could be adversarial in some way. And what he said is the thing that people don't realize is like, if you tell others your problems, the right people will try to help you solve them. And who better to try to help you solve your problems than the people who are financially aligned with seeing you succeed? Oh, he was like that's the key. Just continue to communicate good, bad, or ugly to them and they will help you.
Yeah, like in some ways, you know, I kind of like look at part of, I mean, ultimately I'm responsible for everything good or bad that happens in the business. And I take that responsibility very seriously. But there's a part of the startup CEO where in some ways you're also a little bit more of like the weatherman in the sense that it's like, it's also just your job to sort of report stuff and have a dialogue about why it's going to rain on Tuesday, not like thinking, oh, they're going to yell at me because it's going to rain on Tuesday. Like it is what it is. You just have to be able to have the dialogue. And like, actually Jeff Richards is a really good example of somebody who, you know, believes in that, but actually, you know, really embodies that as a board member. You know, we right after he invested, we hit a little bit of a rough patch with the business, and there was some stuff that we needed to fix. And I called him and I was just like, dude, I think we got to take some growth projections down a little bit. I think we got to make some staff changes. Like, I know this is a little sudden after, you know, we got the deal done. He's like, dude, I don't care. He's like, what I care about is the next 5 years, not the next 5 months. And he's like, I'm just glad you're calling and telling me now, not 6 months from now or a year from now, we got a much bigger problem on our hands, you know? And it's like what ends up happening and the advice I would give a lot of founders is like, I can't tell you the feeling of relief that will wash over you when you have the hard conversation because it's never as hard as you think it's going to be. And you're going to walk out of your office that night going, wow, oh man, like now that's off my chest. We can actually start solving the problem.
Yeah, I wish I had that conversation 6 months ago or 3 months ago.
Yeah, well, you know what I saw? Because when I was at USA Today and when I was at Groupon, you know, both were public companies in the midst of you know, pretty colorful turnarounds, right? And so I think part of what gave me the motivation to be more proactive on having the hard conversations at Electric was living through, you know, two turnarounds at public companies and watching what happens if you just bury problems forever and ever and ever. It's like, guess what? Then someone who's not you is going to come in and flip the lights on and start rummaging around in your business and start telling you how to make the sausage. And usually that ends up with you not having a job anymore. So it's entirely avoidable.
Absolutely. You talked a little bit earlier about when you have the wrong people, being able to kind of get rid of them and get the right people in there. One of the things that I've seen in founder after founder after founder that is very hard for them to get comfortable doing is firing people. Talk a little bit just about kind of your own experience with having to fire people and kind of how you've gotten more comfortable with it over time.
Yeah. I mean, look, it sucks. And everybody at some point in their career goes from having never fired someone to having to let somebody go for the first time. And, you know, I remember back at my first company, right after we got acquired by USA Today, we had a guy on the team who I was always complaining about. I just didn't think was the right fit. And so I reported to my co-founder, Rudd, because he became the GM of the group once we got acquired. And he ended up getting promoted. I became the GM. And he's like, first order of business, you got to let go of that guy you've been complaining about for the last 3 months. I never fired anybody before. I wanted to call out sick for the whole week. So I went home and I watched Hard Knocks on HBO because, you know, what I found was that these NFL coaches are really good at letting people go, you know, because they have to release like half the squad, you know, before the season starts or whatever. And so I just watched a bunch of Hard Knocks episodes and I was like, okay, like you just got to be, you got to be direct. You got to sit down. You just got to do the thing. So whatever. So I got through it. It ended up being fine. But sort of fast forward to today, the biggest thing that we've realized is that you're never going to bat 1,000. You're never going to hire. Always make the best hires. The key is being really clear in the expectations in the first, you know, month, 2 months, and figuring out as soon as possible. And then, you know, what I always tell the company is that all attrition is regrettable, right? If we realize that we've hired somebody and they're not living up to the standard that we want at the business, that's our fault. We shouldn't have hired them. And we should have figured that out before we extended them an offer, before they left their job, before they came over here, right? And so that's always been my stance with the team here, is like, it's always our responsibility if someone's not a fit. And we have to treat it as such. And so as a result, one, we're really clear about expectations so that it's not a surprise, though, no matter how hard you try, it always is for some people. And then the second thing is we try to be pretty generous with severance, more so than one might be for somebody who might have only worked at your company for a month, just because it's our responsibility. You know, we're half the reason that we ended up in that situation. And so I think if you're clear with people and you're a real, like a decent human being about it, send the message to the rest of the org and to that person, wherever they end up next, that, you know, that you're the kind of company that cares about people.
Absolutely. One of the things I'm really interested in is as you guys continue to build Electric and you're providing this IT support, you've got all the internal challenges and just kind of being the CEO, running a business, growing it. But there's also some challenges that your customer base has experienced with the COVID-19 pandemic, the economic shutdown. Talk a little bit just about how you've been able to balance dealing with your internal just scaling obstacles that every business is kind of goes through, but also then having at the same time your customer base go through just changes, right? Some of your businesses may actually be benefiting from it. Some of it may be being hurt by it, but just how have you guys thought through that or how to deal with that?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what's been really interesting is that the more internally focused we get in terms of hiring great people, taking care of them, you know, fostering really productive dialogues around tough issues makes us better with how we deal with our customers, right? And so I'll sort of explain that. But, you know, if you think about if there was ever a year to sort of like earn your stripes as a CEO, like this was definitely one of them, you know, between COVID, between, you know, a lot of the things that are happening, you know, socially and politically. And what's different now versus, you know, even 5 years ago is there's a much different expectation put on CEOs, particularly startup CEOs, around their stance and their voice and their involvement in these things that are happening in the world. And so I think the challenges that I've seen other companies run into are that, you know, these founders and CEOs get so paralyzed over, you know, being afraid to say the wrong thing, that they either wait too long, they say nothing, or they don't really say anything at all, right? They issue some bland statement that was run through marketing or whatever. And at the end of the day, as I said before, it's like companies are a collection of people, right? And so what the employees want, and ultimately what your customers want, is they want to hear from you, the human being. They don't want to hear from you, the venture-backed CEO who's watching every single word. Now, obviously, you have to exercise some discretion. But for example, you know, back in the beginning of June or that last weekend in May, you know, when there were, you know, a lot of the protests started happening in, you know, across America, it was Saturday afternoon. I was standing in my kitchen and I was like, shit, like, I don't know why I have to address this. We have a very diverse, you know, group of employees here. Like, what do I say? What do I, you know, And finally, I just like got, I was standing in my kitchen, I get on my phone. And the first thing I said in the email was, I haven't sent this email yet because I was afraid that I was going to say the wrong thing or that it was going to come off disingenuous. Like I literally just, I opened the email with that just to let everyone working here know, like, I don't really know, but here's how I feel. And I'm just going to put some words down on paper. And the response is amazing. People were like, I'm just glad you said something. I'm glad you spoke from the heart. And so, you know, in contrast, I'm on a bunch of CEO like email threads and stuff. I saw a lot of companies just get smoked because the CEO would hide in a room with their head of HR for a week saying nothing. And it's like, I think when in doubt, you just got to default to, you know, you got to think of your employees almost as if they're an extension of your friends or your family. And it's like, what would you say on a phone call with a sibling or a friend, right? Kind of treat it like that. Don't overthink it.
Yeah. And I also think that this idea of setting expectations is really important as well. Like by simply saying like, hey, I haven't sent this because I've been scared of saying the wrong thing. Like you're taking ownership of the fact that like, here's why this hasn't gone out yet. And two, by the way, here's my vulnerability. So if I say the wrong thing, like I was already worried about that. Right. And it almost is in some weird way, when you tell people, especially in communication, the vulnerability, it seems like they immediately become much more empathetic in the way that they kind of receive the message. And also they're much more understanding if maybe they disagree with you, right? Or they have a different viewpoint. It's just like, hey, look, Ryan's doing the best he can with the information he has. And like, so am I. And we may not see eye to eye on, especially really polarizing, controversial topics, but I appreciate the fact that the person who's leading the company I work at has the courage to say what he believes, how he believes it, and kind of help us all move forward together, right?
100%. I mean, look, everybody, I think about this all the time. Like every person on the planet has some battle they're quietly fighting, some more publicly than others, but like everybody's got something inside that's not going well, some vulnerability, whatever. And so, you know, I think it is, as a leader, as long as you can just show people that like, you're just like them too, I think it gives you a lot more leeway in terms of, you know, it sort of diffuses any tension that might be there. People just look at you like a human. I mean, I sent a note out yesterday, you know, ahead of the election. I basically, you know, what I opened it with was like, listen, I have no unique point of view on politics or election law or anything like that. Okay. But here's a few things that are purely fact-based that I think we should all take into consideration. You know, and I think, and the note went over well, because ultimately I was just saying like, I'm not an expert on this, but like, just here's some facts just so that we can all, you know, kind of align on a few things. And that type of stuff goes over well with people.
Absolutely. One of the things I've been really interested in too is, and maybe we'll close on this, is just as the CEO of a business, there's lots of social issues now. There's obviously the election kind of uncertainty. There's just a lot of non-business activities that are going on. And, you know, I always joke and say that if companies were purely capitalistic in nature and they didn't worry about anything else other than optimizing profits, then there would be no politics in the workplace. There'd be no social issues that you'd ever have to deal with. Like it would just be machines basically, right? Every company would just have like none of the other things that they have to consider. Obviously, though, these companies are made up of people, as we've been talking about. And so those people have political ideologies. They have certain positions on social issues. We've seen CEOs kind of take a couple of different approaches. Some CEOs say, hey, look, we want you to express your opinion here. We want you to kind of feel comfortable having every conversation you'd possibly want. We've also seen on the other end of the spectrum, you know, kind of the Coinbase approach of like, hey, we are a mission-focused company and there's no room for politics in the workplace. How do you, maybe not so much just like which end of the spectrum are you on, but just how do you think through the aspect of like the people who work here have other interests other than just coming to work here every day and operating like a robot? And how are we going to kind of deal with that along with trying to build the company?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I think the first thing, and just sort of going back to sort of the early stages of company building, is the most overlooked hire in every startup is a great head of people, right? And
why?
It's a combination of HR and talent, right? So we hired a VP of people, Jamie Coakley, a couple of years ago. And I can't tell you how big of an unlock that is for me as a CEO, for the rest of our leadership team, to have somebody, if we all believe that a company is just a collection of people, to have somebody whose sole focus it is to just look after sort of the health and well-being of this group of people, right? It's just companies we waited too long, but we nailed it, and or at least, you know, nailed the hire and ultimately got around to it. But companies wait way too long. And the reality is, like, if you believe that the people side of the business is that important, you have to invest in having somebody to sort of run that. So that's a huge thing that most companies overlook, that you got to get it dialed in. The second piece is what I always try to get people to understand, and what we really believe in here, is that using the company as a force for good is inherently a competitive advantage and a force for good. So I don't care, how rigorous your like moral compass is. At the end of the day, if all you are is just a purely capitalist, profit-driven person, it's still better business to be a good human and to be inclusive and to have a diverse, team and a diversity of opinions. And so, for us, I think when, back in, June, July, when a lot of companies were announcing like, oh, we've donated $100,000 to the ACLU, or we did this, or we did that. Hey, look, that's fine. Those are all really good causes. But internally, we looked at it and we said, our payroll is going to be $35 million next year. If we can make our recruiting processes even a little bit more diverse, a little bit more inclusive, I have a $35 million money cannon that can actually create real change in real communities, right? And so, and the sort of follow-on effects that has in terms of the company culture that you build and productivity, all that stuff, it's all very obvious. Salesforce is a great example of a company who I think really led the way on this. Mark with his like 1-1-1 kind of pledge approach. And I can't tell you the number of Salesforce executives who I've spoken with over the years were like, that's a big reason they went there, and it's a big reason they stuck around. So, I don't know if that directly answered the question, but we've tried to orient the company really around that, as like, how do we use the whole thing as a force for good? And then in return, we have a diversity of employees who all have different opinions and different things that they care about. But look, at the end of the day, they recognize that we're trying to do good in running this company. And as long as their opinions and their interests don't hurt anyone, then that's what diversity is all about. We support it.
Yeah. What's so interesting about your answer is it really highlights just the complexity of all of this. There is no black or white answer, right? There is no kind of single magic bullet of like, hey, here's the position to take. And if you take that position, then it's going to solve all your problems. Like, there is complexity, and that's ultimately a net positive if used the correct way. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I always wrap up every interview with the same two questions, and then you'll get to ask me one question to finish it. The first question is, what is the most important book you've ever read?
It's interesting. It's going to be a less shallow answer than it probably sounds like. But when I was in high school, I used to walk around with a copy of Barbarians at the Gate. And I probably read it 5 times. And it was, I think, I was just in the early days of starting a business, but it was so colorful and so fascinating reading about these crazy, leveraged buyouts and all this stuff, which I had didn't know anything about that stuff at the time. But like me as a high school kid realizing this is business, or it just opened my eyes to just, what was possible and just how gnarly things were. And so, I've read plenty of books that are much more impactful, professionally. I'm staring at a copy of Tape Sucks, which is Frank Slootman's book, which is awesome. I've already read it twice. But now Barbarians at the Gate, I think because I read it as a 16-year-old, was hugely influential.
It's a great book. And Tape Sucks is another good one. So those are two good suggestions. What about the second question, which is more fun? Aliens. Are you a believer or a non-believer?
Big time. I mean, come on. You can't. If you just look at the data, statistically, there has to be alien life. In one of our weekly exec team meetings, we went off on a tangent for 10 minutes at the beginning of our meeting, and we like genuinely debated it. And I think we all came to the conclusion, like, there are for sure aliens out there. And maybe it's like some worm on some, moon outside of some random planet, or maybe it's intelligent life, but it's definitely out there.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you, but we'll see. There's some deep signal coming from the galaxy, supposedly. I was reading this morning. So we'll see what's going on there. You could ask me one question to wrap us up. What do you got for me?
Well, yeah, seeing as how your listeners are a lot of folks who are kind of hobbyist investors in one way, shape, or form or another, what's one trend, whether it's a trend, an asset class, an individual company, though you probably don't want to be given stock tips on air. But what's one thing if you if you had to place a bet that you think is an overlooked bet for 2021 for people who are investing, what would it be?
Yeah. So I don't know if there's necessarily one. There's probably just a theme. And the theme that I always talk about is like the fringe of society. So right now, if you said to me, like, what are the things on the fringe of society that maybe like your weird friend is into, right? It's kind of the way I think about it. And like that one weird friend who you can't figure out, like, are they just weird or are they actually smart and just thinking about different things? But like, okay, so space, psychedelics, cryptocurrency, right? I mean, like that's all the things that everyone's got that friend who's always like, on the tip of the spear of like the weird stuff. Well, what we found is that weird stuff usually makes its way into the mainstream, right? Or some good percentage of it. And so just take the three things I just named there, like space. Now's not weird. Like now everyone's like, yeah, of course, like space is going to become much more popular. 10, 15 years ago, like that was kind of fringe. Like you're telling me you're going to like launch a rocket and then re-land it. That was a crazy idea. I think cryptocurrency maybe like 5 years ago was super fringe.
I'm literally having flashbacks to being at Zach Prince's apartment in 2016. And he takes a sip of his drink and he's like, Denny, have you been buying any Bitcoin? And I'm like, you're nuts. You're crazy.
Right. So like 5 years ago, crypto was like super fringe. You have that one friend, Zach Prince, who ends up going to build BlockFi, right? Who's like kind of like out there. Now I think like psychedelics is a huge place, right? All the like the drug decriminalization that's happening. Like there's just a whole area there that like I frankly don't understand really well.
And there's a great company called Mindbloom, another friend of mine, similar to the Zach Prince story, but a few years later, my buddy Dylan, he goes, hey, I'm starting this company. It's ketamine therapy. And I was like, you're nuts. You're going to get VCs to give you money to send people ketamine in the mail. And, you know, I'm already regretting not investing. So I think you're totally right with this recommendation.
Yeah. And so like the reason why I say it's a theme more so than just like one asset class, if you will, or one kind of industry is, okay, we just identified three. There's probably 10 more that like that one friend is already thinking about that just hasn't seeped enough into like the mainstream for like me to know about yet.
Well, think about like esports, right? Like there's going to be a professional gaming league for World of Warcraft. 10 years ago, people were like, no.
Absolutely. And if you, again, Play VS, right? If you look at like what Delane's built there, they basically built an entire national system that mirrors the NCAA, right? But for gaming across all these schools. And so it's just, I think that a lot about like investors are rewarded for one, being early and two, being right. And a lot of times when you're early, that means you have to do something different than everybody else. And so like, sure, are there people that will spend all of their time trying to figure out, you know, is Starbucks current revenue multiple too high or too low? And what's the future earnings based on, you know, their rollout plan and their international expansion? And like, sure. And there's people who are good at that. That's not me, right? And that's not where my interest lies. Instead, my interest is much more in like, what's that next thing that people are going to be talking about in 5 years that they're like, wow, remember when I was talking to Ryan and Ryan mentioned to me like this thing and I thought he was crazy? Well, now it became a thing.
I mean, I remember when I had, you know, my best performing seed investment to date has been a company called Stadium Goods. These guys raised less than $10 million, sold for $250 million to Farfetch. That stock is now ripping. Was awesome outcome for everybody. But I remember in 2015 when they started the company, you know, and I was trying to make interest to investors for Jed and John, and the people were like, oh, I don't know. Like, are people going to care about sneakers, particularly like used ones, this and that? And it's like, dude, streetwear literally is the next wave of high fashion for, you know, millennials and Gen Z. And it's like, so yeah, I don't know. I feel like if I could sum up this whole podcast, that my two big takeaways are, be a good human and bet on the fringes.
That is a fantastic way to wrap this up. Where can people find you on the internet or find out more about Electric?
Yeah. So the best thing is if anything I said about Electric sounds interesting, just go to electric.ai. If you want to find me on social, I am at DennehyXXL on all platforms.
Awesome, man. Listen, thank you so much for doing this. I think people are really going to like this one, and hopefully people will have a bunch of takeaways. So I'll have to do it again in the future.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks.